1, 2, 3.
Welcome to In the Studio. For three decades now, the first-person stories of and by the greatest rock musicians in history. I'm Redbeard, your conductor on this rock and roll train. And today in the studio, the conclusion of our special on the Jimi Hendrix Experience's release of Electric Ladyland.
We were on the road, and I do recall there were riots going on in Detroit, and we go just to get from the hotel to the car, to the limo. You go through the revolving doors, and it was like, you know, be careful, there's a bit of sniper fire. But the worst was no doubt when Martin Luther King was assassinated. I believe that night we were playing in Newark, New Jersey. We were based in New York, so we drove over, and the riots were, you know, just taking really, really hold. I mean, you could see burning buildings. And as we're driving to the gig wasn't cancelled. Two shows booked for that night, and there were tanks on the corners of the streets. Hi, this is Mitch Mitchell of the Jimi Hendrix Experience in the studio for the making of Electric Ladyland.
Quickly recapping where we left off in part one, Jimi Hendrix had returned to his native America as a new star with his London entourage in tow. Midway through recording their third album, Electric Ladyland, Jimmy's mentor, producer, and co-manager Chaz Chandler grew increasingly frustrated thousands of miles from his London power base and quit, leaving Hendrix to complete the recording in New York City with his British rhythm section of drummer Mitch Mitchell and converted bass player Noel Redding, plus recording engineer Eddie Kramer. Here is Hendrix biographer and executive producer of the 50th anniversary of Electric Ladyland, John McDermott.
During the Electric Ladyland recording sessions, you know, it wasn't as if they were able to take a full break and just commit themselves to recording. You know, at the start of 1968, Axis Bold as Love had just been released. Jimmy was playing colleges, small, you know, clubs, things of that nature. All during the recording of the record, their popularity is skyrocketing. Underground FM radio is taking hold all across the United States. Word of Jimmy's, you know, performances and our experience at Axis Bold as Love being out there, you know, tremendous success, selling not only to, you know, small audiences, but now, you know, top 10 in the U.S. So by the time we get to the end of Electric Ladyland, Jimi Hendrix is headlining sports arenas, the Hollywood Bowl, major places. So the growth in their popularity is exponential in what is really a nine-month period. So I think that pressure to maximize the popularity of the group and the demand for public appearances, coupled with the pressure of just kind of make a double record, it was hard, and I think it really it exposed some of the fissures that were there between, particularly with Jimmy and Noel, and, you know, with Chaz Chandler now taking removing himself as a producer. You know, it wasn't as if there was an army of people around Jimmy advising him. I mean, it was a very small operation, and I think that this was the height of the original experience as a recording unit was this record. You know, they would go on through 69 as a brilliant live band, really up until June of 1969 when Noel left. But this is the apex of the experience as a three-piece recording unit, without question.
Must be some kind of way out of here, said a joker to the thief. There's too much confusion, I can't get no relief. Businessman there, drink my wine. Plowman, dig my earth. None will level on the mine. Nobody of it is worth. Hey, hey.
but you and I, we've been through that, and this is not our fate. So let us not talk falsely now. The hour's getting late. Hey!
On the 1968 third Jimi Hendrix Experience album, there appeared a cover of an obscure Bob Dylan song that Hendrix so completely made his own that we still have to constantly remind ourselves that the singer is not the composer. Here's Experience drummer Mitch Mitchell.
Jimmy, for a chap that, as I found out, hadn't had that much schooling, really, just came out with his profound lyrics, which showed a depth of character that was completely unexpected to me. You know, I mean, I'm thinking back things like, you know, Manic Depression. He really liked Bob Dylan as a lyricist. And in that way, in the very early formative period of the band, when you are finding out each other's tastes, musical and otherwise, I'd be sort of attempting to turn him on, or, you know, say, playing maybe a bit of John Coltrane or Roland Kirk or Miles Davis or, you know, whatever. And at the same token, he'd be showing me things, you know, some Dylan. You know, of course, I was aware of Bob Dylan's work for many, many years, but I'd never played in a situation using it, doing any Dylan stuff. I never paid attention to the lyrics either, you know. And so it enlightened me a lot. That's the wonderful thing with Jimmy and, well, the relationship I was fortunate enough to have with him. It's very rare in a musician's life that you can play with, you know, some wonderful, wonderful schooled players, wonderful players, period. They can be your best friends, but they might not be the best players. But when you find someone that is prepared to take a chance on anything, it's a risk. You know, that's how new music is formed. By making mistakes a lot of times, because, you know, this wasn't written down as such. It was just throwing ideas back and forth, you know, and Jimmy was never scared of trying something in a new direction, and that really appealed to me.
In this 50th anniversary edition of Electric Ladyland is included a letter from Jimi Hendrix to his U.S. record company, penned on hotel stationery while on the road touring, and it's the first indication of the 25-year-old musician starting to be overwhelmed by trying to fill the shoes of his former manager, Chaz Chandler. Here's biographer John McDermott.
I think what Jimmy is saying in his letter to Warner Brothers is that, you know, they're in the midst of a hurricane. There's a lot that's going on. The interpersonal relationships within the band itself. You know, Chaz Chandler had stepped back as a producer, leaving Jimmy to produce the record and finish the record. So I think there's a lot going on there. And I also think that the demands of touring were such that, you know, Jimmy was doing this stuff under duress from a hotel room, just saying, look, make sure this, just follow my lead here. Don't change it. This is what I want. I have a vision for this. The artists, for the first time, I think by 1968, particularly with Jimi Hendrix, had the power to at least influence a lot of the decisions which had previously been made for groups by record labels. You know, here Jimi Hendrix is saying, no, I want these pictures laid out in this way. I want my poem, my letter to the Room Full of Mirrors in there. I want to make sure these credits are in there. I mean, now we look at an album and you see, you know, a phone book full of credits, for God's sakes. Back then it was a lot for the Beatles to acknowledge a Jeff Emerick, or for the Experience to acknowledge somebody like Eddie Kramer as their recording engineer. You know, so it was important for Jimmy to call out these players like Al Kooper and Jack Cassidy and others who had played on his record. So, you know, different era, but important to Jimmy. And I just think, given all that was going on in his life, that, you know, the excitement of success. I mean, you can't, you know, discount the fact that these were guys in their early 20s and living a dream and finally seeing his talent blossom in a way and be accepted by an audience in a way 2 years before was unthinkable. But I think what happened when they came to New York was that, you know, Jimmy by that point had felt that some of the mixing and some of the recording of Axis was rushed. He wanted more time, and he wanted the ability to develop things in the studio as opposed to having everything finished, then bring it to the studio and then record it. So I think philosophically that became an issue between Jimmy and Chaz. And then I think when Jimmy was really looking to go beyond what he had done on the previous two records, I think that was where Chaz struggled. You know, when you take a song like 1983, you know, the sound painting, this particular vision that Jimmy had, it's just streets away from anything that had been on Axis, a brilliant record, or Are You Experienced, a brilliant record. So I think Jimmy was growing so fast that it was difficult perhaps for Chaz to see the commercial potential in that music. But I don't think he would have opposed the double record at all. I just think, you know, it was how it was recorded and at the speed it was recorded. Jerry Stickles, who served Jimi Hendrix loyally and ably as his road manager for his entire career, you know, said, you know, that record cost $70,000 and all we heard were complaints. All these years later, nobody complains about that. And I think he's right. It stood the test of time. It was worth the money. It was worth the time. All that sweat that went into it to create it is what makes it today a lasting work. It's a touchstone for people who are interested in Jimi Hendrix, whether it comes through Voodoo Child Site Return or All on the Watchtower or Rainy Day Dream Away. It doesn't matter. That's the record you want to go to because it's such a deep well.
Ever falling dust that makes it so hard for me to see that forgotten era.
Burning of the Midnight Lamp, a psychedelic relic that was a key recording for the future life of Jimi Hendrix and the careers of so many that radiated off of that central hub. Up next, Noel Redding is replaced in the studio, while a king is assassinated in Memphis, a prince assassinated in L.A. on his way to the presidency, and America burns during the long hot summer of 1968. Electric Ladyland by the Jimi Hendrix Experience, Part 2. Welcome back in the studio, Electric Ladyland by the Jimi Hendrix Experience. I'm Redbeard. In part one, we learned that frustrations in the studio had escalated to the point where producer and co-manager Chas Chandler had walked out midway through the recording of Electric Ladyland and returned to England. It turns out that experienced bass player Noel Redding agreed with Chandler, according to drummer Mitch Mitchell.
The amount of time we spent in the studio on a track, that really used to grate with Chaz. And with Noel, it was like, you know, in, get it done, get it in and out, in and out. Whereas with Jimmy and possibly myself, you know, it could go take after take after take after take. And often you would come back and you find out Chaz was right. Like a case being, early days, we crept into the studio to do, we had to have a single out, and we went and we just did a demo of The Wind Cries Mary. Played it a couple of times, put it down on tape. That was it. Went out on the road, came back the next week to record it properly. And we stuck with the demo, you know, because it just felt better. So often that's where it is good to hear, have another pair of ears of to say, come on, you're wasting time. The first one, it's fresh. And Chaz was being pushed in a direction that he wasn't at all happy with. He just recently married, and I think he'd had enough of the games, quite honestly, and the lunacy. But it was lunacy at that point. It was. I mean, you know, it was getting burnout time because the band, I mean, we were doing two shows a night. When I look at the itinerary, we did, 49 cities in 52 days, two shows a night. And, you know, you didn't see anything apart from an early morning flight, the same hotel room only 1,000 miles away, you know, the stage. And that's all you had to look forward to. That was the release of just going and getting on stage and doing that and doing the concerts. If that was bad, and it often, you know, the mix would be fouled up, or the sound quality, the sound balance would be absolute dire. You know, Jimmy would throw a wobbly, or, I mean, you know, people would say, oh, that was a great gig tonight. But, you know, only you know it wasn't. Not from where we were.
Hendrix executive producer and author John McDermott.
Is that Jimi Hendrix really enjoyed technology. And so, you know, he bought himself a reel-to-reel that he could, you know, thread up his tapes, and he bought himself a consumer-grade TIAC reel-to-reel machine, set it up in his apartment, in his hotel room, and recorded these demos. It was important to him. He didn't read or write music, so his way of documenting his creativity was to just record it. And Eddie Kramer talks about going to the Drake Hotel in New York where Jimmy was living because he had come back to America. Remember, when he went to England in September of 66, he had nothing, left nothing, went with his bag. You know, so when he came back here, he didn't have an apartment and everything. He still had his family in Seattle. But, you know, in Manhattan, he was put into a hotel room and, you know, immediately bought the machine, was able to, you know, start putting these ideas down onto tape. Eddie talks about going over to the Drake and, you know, kind of helping him a little bit with his setup. But, you know, it's a very simple process. Two microphones and his guitar and an amp turned really down low, because you can imagine you're in a hotel room with other guests in the same building. You know, you hear, if you listen closely, you can hear some of the outside traffic and noise in some of the demo recordings. And that's the beauty of it. It's the intimacy of it. It was really the key word for this entire project, was allowing you to get a vision, an insight into that creative process that led to this amazing record.
Stains from silver blue to bloody red, as our feet find the sand and the sea straight ahead. Straight ahead. Too bad that our friends can't be with us today. The machine that we built would never save us, they would say. Giant phones greet us with a smile. Before our heads go under, we take a last look. The killing noise of the outer style.
Hendrix drummer, the late Mitch Mitchell.
We found it, at that time as well, sometimes it was easier and faster to work with just, say, Jimmy and myself, with just a rhythm guitar and drums, and Jimmy, he put the bass on afterwards. It wasn't an ideal way of working, but, you know, that's what we did. Thing was, there was still a lot of concerts to do as the Experience, as a three-piece, and not long after that, when Changes did go down, we did a band with, you know, more pieces. We did the Woodstock Festival with more pieces added, but that didn't feel that comfortable either, or that it was just the wrong band. So consequently, Jimmy and myself, we just went back to the three-piece, but that time with Billy Cox, and that was coming towards the end of for the last year. And that band, with Billy Cox, myself and Jimmy, was quite a bit different from the Experience. I've got fond memories of that particular band. It was quite powerful in its own way, in a much different way musically than the original Experience. And the Experience thing put a lot of pressure on Jimmy that he didn't like, which he created himself, like, you know, getting known for burning the guitar and the rest of the wild, so, you know, inverted commas, wild show that went with it, you know, because people did expect, the word got around that, you know, here's a guy that plays guitar with its teeth and behind his back and this, that and the other. And that gets very boring. I mean, like that's across to bear Jimmy had to live with. And yeah, I know, it's his own monster.
So down and down and down and down and down we go. Hurry, my darling, we must not be late for the show. Neptune champion games to an aqua world is so dear. Right this way, says a mermaid, I can hear.
Hendrix biographer John McDermott.
What's so exciting about the presenting those demo recordings, you know, 1983, for example, you hear it in that form of just Jimmy in his, you know, hotel room with his amp turned really down low, recording on his own personal reel-to-reel recording unit. You know, it's a simple consumer-grade machine. It isn't any fancy thing like that. And then we advance it to a recording from March 68 at Dunnett Sound Center because the record plant had not yet opened. And so, again, Jimmy's experimenting. He's got Stephen Stills with him and Buddy Miles. And so in March of 68, before the record plant is open, Jimmy goes in to record a version of 1983, and he has Noel on bass and Buddy Miles on drums, two musicians who aren't on the final master when he records it a couple of months later at the record plant. And just by hearing that, you realize that there's a feel to the song, and even though you see and hear the potential, it's not where he wants it. So we really felt that that was a great way to show the arc of the story of this great song. Intimate, solo, writing the song, you feel like you're in the room kind of eavesdropping on him, to the first attempt to record it in a proper studio, and ultimately on the album you hear the, you know, the 17, 18 minute sound painting, which is a permanent and fixed part of his legacy.
So down and down and down and down and down and down we go. Hurry, my darling, we mustn't be late for the show. Neptune champion games to an aqua world is so dear. Right this way smiles a mermaid, I can hear a man.
Electric Ladyland is exactly what it is, and it's important for an artist who died young, who was unable to kind of, you know, resolve his legacy in a way. You know, that's, it's different from artists, and even the Beatles, though George and John have passed, you still have Paul, and prior to his passing, George Martin and Ringo, still being able to kind of say, no, contextually, this is where we were trying to go. And I think what our mission is to try to help fans get an appreciation and understanding that they may not have had previously. So if you really love 1983, here's a chance to hear where it came from. It's not going to replace the version you love, but it may give you a deeper understanding of it than you ever had before. That's our goal. That's why it's important on a set like this, as opposed to putting it on a standalone record and, you know, trying to make it an alternate or a different version in any type of way. It's important, I think, for people to hear, God, this is how Jimi Hendrix composed. You know, that in itself is a revelation.
There's an example of the world's first electronic composer, James Marshall Hendrix, on the song 1983 from the album Electric Ladyland. Next, amidst the civil rights unrest and race riots in U.S. cities in 1968, plus the Chicago rioting during the 68 Democratic Convention, Jimi Hendrix, a 25-year-old black male, leads an all-white band on tour through the segregated South. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, on Twitter at Redbeard Rocks, and you can get a lot more at inthestudio.net. Welcome back in the studio for the conclusion of Electric Ladyland by the Jimi Hendrix Experience. I'm Redbeard. Amidst all the returning heroic adulation that was being heaped upon Jimi Hendrix, the album certainly wasn't conceived in a vacuum. On balance, 1968 certainly was the worst year in American history since World War II. Mitch Mitchell saw a marked difference when 25-year-old James Marshall Hendrix, a black American, led his all-white band into the segregated South in 1968 and then up to the Democratic National Convention in Chicago.
I mean, Jimmy was well aware of where he came from and what he was about as a man, and on a racial side. I mean, you know, Jimmy and I had spoken of it, you know, a few times, because he had the American Indian blood as well. On the Martin Luther King, on the civil rights issue, it wasn't until we were on the road, and I do recall there were riots going on in Detroit, and we go, just to get from the hotel to the car, to the limo, you go through the revolving doors, and it was like, you know, be careful, it was a bit of sniper fire. But the worst was no doubt when Martin Luther King was assassinated. I believe that night we were playing in Newark, New Jersey. We were based in New York, so we drove over, and the riots were, you know, just taking really, really hold. I mean, you could see burning buildings. And as we're driving to the gig wasn't cancelled. Two shows booked for that night, and there were tanks on the corners of the streets. And the National Guard, that's what I was searching for, thank you. There was actually some people there for the first show, but they cancelled the second one. It was highly, highly dangerous.
And change the subject and said, oh, well, I think it might snow some. So I left him sipping his tea, and I jumped in my chair and run off to see just why and who could it be this time. Sisters and brothers, daddy's mother standing around crying. When I reached the scene, the flames were making a ghostly whine. So I stood on my horse's back, and I screamed without a breath. I
say, oh baby, why did you burn your brother's house down? Disgusting, so we paint red to the sky. I said the truth is straight ahead, so don't burn yourself instead. Try to learn instead of burn, hear what I say. So I burned and rolled away, but I'll never forget that day. Cause when I reached the valley, I looked way down across the way. A giant boat from space landed with eerie grace and came and taken all the dead away.
Certainly alarmed by the race riots in Watts, Detroit, Hough, Murray Hill, and hundreds of other U.S. cities in 1968 after the assassination of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., that's the Jimi Hendrix Experience with the song House Burning Down from the album Electric Ladyland. Again, Hendrix biographer John McDermott.
Yeah, that is very true. I mean, you know, Mitch really shined on this record. And I think one of the things when we dug into some of the outtakes that we presented, you know, it gives you the chance to see how Jimmy approached recording at this time. You know, it's hard to imagine being able to create music as complex as, you know, Gypsy Eyes or House Burning Down or Long Hot Summer Night without having a bass player. So initially you're talking about Jimmy and Mitch getting together, Jimmy working out the song, showing Mitch how the arrangement was going to be, and then those two would cut the track, and then Jimmy would come back on and put the bass on and put additional guitars on and other elements. But there was a relationship between Jimmy and Mitch that was really unique and supportive, and yet at the same time, they challenged each other. I mean, Mitch wasn't there to just take direction. Jimmy wanted him to bring that particular talent and skill that he had to the fore. And, you know, when you listen to that record, Mitch is playing incredibly. Well, when Jimmy and Eddie Kramer were doing a lot of the mixing for Electric Ladyland, I mean, Jimmy was thrilled by, you know, Eddie's openness to panning and a lot of the techniques that he, whether it's phasing, flanging, all of these things, you know, to create a fresh sound. And that was completely up Jimmy's alley. He loved that kind of a thing. So I think in Voodoo Child Slight Return, one of the things that they worked on was trying to get movement of the stereo image, really almost, you know, in advance of this idea of what we now know as surround sound. And Eddie has always told me there was a moment when they were mixing Budo Cha Site Return, where they heard the sound behind them, in front of them and behind them. They had, you know, whether it was putting things out of phase, doing something in there. They can't remember how they got there, but there was that aha moment where they looked at each other and said, did you hear that? So that goal was always in their mind, was to try to create something that was sound, that was 3D, Jimmy would say, and it would go all around your head. And so when we did, we made the decision to mix the album in 5.1, Eddie was really pushing for this because he felt this was really what Jimmy had wanted. The forward edge of technology always appealed to him. So the idea of going back to the original 1-inch 12-track masters for every song and creating a surround sound mix was really a challenge, but Kramer loved it. He was very excited about it. It was something we spent a lot of time working on. And the first song we did was Voodoo Child Slight Return, because Eddie was convinced that we had to get to that moment where, as a 5.1 mix, he would feel like they had replicated that thing they achieved for just a minute in 1968. So we did it. And it was an emotional thing for Eddie. He was so excited. He was like, this is it. This is how it's got to be. Jimmy would love this. So we continued on from there. That was kind of the wind in our sails. And it took quite a bit of time to do it, because what we were really trying to be very careful with was to match the stereo mixing. So whether, you know, if the original had flanging or phasing or, you know, particular kind of panning, Eddie could now go through all the different speakers with the panning, but it's not going to sound totally different to the song you love. When you listen to Crosstown Traffic or you listen to All on the Watchtower, it still has that mix, but now you feel like you're in the room with Jimmy. You're in the middle of this creativity, and it's really great. When we put together a box set like the deluxe edition of Electric Ladyland, we're all fully aware that I've had the record. I've had the record in many iterations. Many fans throughout the world have done the same. So if you're happy with the record you have, of course, that's great. But I think what we're specifically trying to do here is to just go deeper. So that's the purpose of the hotel demos and the studio outtakes and, you know, adding the bootleg live recording of Hollywood Bowl, the 5.1 mixing. It's really to allow the fans to have a deeper appreciation and understanding of Jimmy's great music. But it's also, you have to understand that, you know, there's successive generations come to this music and they want it now. They're not necessarily interested in, you know, that you bought your album at Woolworths in 1968 and why would you bother re-releasing it again? You know, that's great. You know, but I think Jimmy's audience is one that is continually turning over and expanding and growing. You see that with the Beatles. You see that with a select group of artists of that era. But certainly Hendrix is at the forefront of it, where if you're a young 14-year-old kid and you want to learn what Jimi Hendrix is all about, you know, you don't have the opportunity to see him live as those who bought the record in 1968 did. So our job is to say, hey, if you want to get deep on this guy, here's where some of the songs came from. This is kind of how he approached his songwriting. This is how he wrote lyrics. This is what it sounds like in 5.1 sound, which didn't exist in 1968, but exists now and can be used to celebrate this album in a very compelling way. So that's the important part of really managing the legacy in such a way that it's accessible to everybody, his original fans plus contemporary fans who may not have this music before. So you try to serve all masters in this. In addition to putting out classic records on vinyl, for example, part of our mission is to share all of the music that he was recording and intended to release in some form on future records. It's not to say this is exactly how it was going to be, but at the same time, it's important because this is all the art we have. I often say, if you could find one more Wire recording of Robert Johnson, you wouldn't put it away, you'd share it. So that's our mission, is to share. There's only so much Jimi Hendrix, and the very best of it should be shared with his fans throughout the world. Whether you come to it right now or you come to it 10 years from now, once you dip your toe in the water, Jimmy's got you, because the quality is such that you want to be in with him. We'll be right back.
Chandler died in 1996, Noel Redding passed in 2003, and just days after completing a U.S. Jimi Hendrix tribute tour, Dear Sweet Mitch Mitchell died in November 2008. May God bless their souls. I'm Redbeard. I'll be back in the studio after this. This is Redbeard in the studio, thanking my guests. In the Studio is written and produced by yours truly for Bearded Fish Productions. Copyright 2018, all rights reserved. Transcription by Jane Carpenter Brunet. Theme song by Andy Timmons. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and online at inthestudio.net.